Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we'll be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. So our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the Technical Net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. I hope somebody's out there. Looking forward to a good net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I know that we have you, we have me, and we have on the Echo Link Joe, N2DEJ, and William, AC2ZV. And I'm sure one or two other people might be listening in. So, with all that in mind, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net is now on. So if you have any questions or topics of discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign. Well, it seems that we have listeners, but no one interested in talking right now. So I don't know how to deal with it. I usually come up with some kind of story. I don't really have much to say. My Flex radio is still, it's actually being fixed, and hopefully it'll be shipped back real soon. I don't know if it's going to make it for this weekend. But definitely, the way it sounds, by next weekend, I'll be back on the 10-meter net. So I'm looking forward to that. And I've been told by some people that 10-meter propagation has improved a little bit over the last month that I've been without my radio. So I look forward to taking a look at that. Anyway, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So once again, if anyone has any questions or topics for discussion, comments to be made, then hit that push to talk and ID yourself. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Hi, this is Joe, N2DEJ. I don't have a real radio question, Roy, but I was going to ask you something about that weather station. I really like it. I'm going to get it. I want to know how that airstrike, a nearby lightning strike proximity warning, how that works on it, because that would be very useful to me out here in the desert. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's a very clever design. You'll notice if you look at the literature that it has a solar battery to charge. It also uses it, I think, to give an indication of both the infrared and general light intensity. There's a lux readout. So it does a very simple thing. It registers the electromagnetic pulses, and I think it has a sound receptor, and listens for the thunder, and correlates the difference between the light, the RF, and the thunder noise, and it gives you a nice approximation. And it's a legitimate approximation, because I've been around where, you know, the neighborhood lights up and you hear the thunder almost simultaneously, and it reads less than 1 mile, which is, you know, the you know, it won't give you down to the feet. And other times where you see the light flashing and then a few seconds later you hear the thunder. So it's a clever design. I really like it. It's very unobtrusive. It doesn't look like a weather station. Weather stations have this kind of cookie look on it. You know, they have fins on fans to tell you the speed of the wind, but this is all built internally. The only thing I would recommend is find a good open place to mount it, because if you kind of put it in near an enclosed area, it's going to give a somewhat distorted wind result. So, you know, elevate it a little bit if you can, and try not to have a lot of things next to it that could impede the wind movement.
Roger. I'll either put it up on my roof or just put it up on a pole out somewhere on the edge of the property. But I like that. It looks great. My wife won't even know it's there, which is the best thing about it. It's so unobtrusive. She won't even realize it's there. Won't know what it is compared to the other things. And I really like that nearby lightning strike feature, because out here, it's not like Brooklyn. You can kind of tell when it's close to you. Out here, it's just, you know, off to the horizon. You can see so far. Not really sure how far away it is. So that's great. All right, back to you, Roy.
I'm glad that you found it interesting. Like I said, I did too. The only downside is, like many other devices these days, it's a Internet of Things cloud-based design. So if for whatever reason, and I don't see it happening anytime in the near future, the business goes kaput and the servers go down, then you have a very expensive paperweight. But, you know, again, I think they went public. I think they had a stock option thing that they were promoting. So they seem to be doing well. They're also, I think, selling a lot of this weather data to weather companies. So that's another way of them making a profit. So I think they're a clever organization. This is kind of a novel design I've never seen before. Pretty much 99.9% of all weather stations look very, very similar, and this one certainly does not. So I really like it. The apps work very nicely. You can call it up on a web browser page if you have internet service. And I have even been able to connect it to my new Hubitat home control system, so I can feed the temperature, wind, or whatever, and have it perform actions under circumstances. So it's a real nice toy.
I'm going to get it as soon as I get back into my house there and open up my my Radio Shack. All right, thanks, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, you're very welcome. As always, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. I see that we have a new person on the Echo Link, Nikita. So hello, Nikita. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk and say your piece.
This is AC2ZV checking in. How you doing, Roy? Just wanted to just say hi, and I had a little question for you. I've been seeing on the internet there's all this hype about frequencies, you know, how they like 432 rather than A440. I was wondering if you heard about that hyphen, whether or not that means anything to anything.
I'm not exactly sure what you're alluding to. If you could kind of rephrase it, maybe I'll understand it the second time.
So, there are these websites that advertise harmonic numbers and stuff like that, and they say that 432 is supposed to be this great number, and then but apparently we changed the tuning of the A to 440. And this has apparently made everybody more aggressive. So because 432 was a more perfect sound or something like that, it's in line with this 8 hertz cycle that goes back and forth between the ionosphere and the Earth with the lightning. And supposedly that makes it more harmonious of a frequency. So I don't know. Do you think there's anything to the tuning of the note A that makes a difference to music at all? Why we have it one way or the other way? Is it because it's harmonious, or is it because it's legislated?
I'm not aware that there's any actual legislation about musical tones, although it wouldn't surprise me a great deal. Now, I'll kind of deconstruct some of the things that you said. Over at Limark's Technical Net, there is a fellow who is deeply interested in the idea of the ionosphere and the surface of the Earth offering a waveguide resonant at what's called the Schumann frequency, which is a very, very low frequency, which I think is what you're alluding to, which has nothing to do with nothing. It's just a characteristic of the way our ionosphere works. If the dimensions were a little different, the harmonics, the resonances would be a little bit different. No, I think all this is gobbledygook. This is almost as bad as gematria, which is that the Bible and a whole bunch of other books are actually encoded with secret messages that if you add up the value for each letter in going right and left and up and down and diagonal, it'll tell you who killed JFK. So I don't believe in any of that. It's not really, as far as I understand the nature of musicality, it's more the interval difference. Octaves simply sound better to our hearing apparatus. Of course, European and American music is not atonal. Asian music sometimes is atonal without the octaves that we're particularly used to. So it's more the differences than where you start out, as far as I'm aware, as far as music theory goes.
To NVB with a comment.
We got a musician on board. We might as well take an opportunity of that.
I'm sorry, was that for me? Kenny to NVB with a comment?
Yeah, Bob, you're a musician, aren't you?
Yes, I don't personally know of any kind of music that doesn't use the octave. That's just so basic, so standard that the notes an octave apart have that same sound. like scales, like there are other scales that don't split it into 12 parts. They split it into different kinds of subdivisions, but the octave, as far as I know, is constant with any kind of music anywhere in the world. Back to you.
Okay, it was my understanding that in Asia, it's not popular these days, but historically, they had used somewhat an atonal musical frame for music. I don't know how many thousand years ago that was. It's more historical. You know, American and European culture has pretty much stomped out everyone else's creativity.
I never heard of that. It's like, I mean, like Indian music, which I actually like a lot, listen to it. I mean, they have these different ragas and these other kinds of music. And like I say, but everybody has the octave. I mean, even atonal music has octaves. Yeah, I mean, there could have been some European, Eurocentric music critic calling somebody that doesn't use the 12-tone Western scale atonal, or maybe there's something I don't know about. but I'd be very surprised if there was any system that didn't acknowledge the octave. I don't see how that would even work. Anyway, back to you.
Okay, like I said, I'm not really a specialist in music theory, but I think I heard going back into the ancient days, because, you know, there's a lot of actual documented history of the development of music. Most instruments that we take for granted were only really invented in the last 400 or 500 years, the most. Most of the instruments they used, wind instruments, I guess, and chimes and such, predate that. But, you know, most of the things that we look and see in a orchestra didn't exist about 500 years ago.
Yeah, some did. The different forms of violins, and most of them existed in one form, an earlier form, like their trumpets. They had sort of basic. We'll go 500. If you go back farther, yeah, I don't know. I don't know everything about music history either, but it's definitely evolved in those last 500 years. There were these different. The old gambas and all these other different things, and, you know, Bach and before Bach and all that kind of stuff, and the flutes and the trumpets. They had trumpets that had holes instead of valves. And anyway, suffice to say, I'll just leave it there.
Okay, yeah, I mean, they were much more primitive mechanisms. Because, you know, they didn't really have the ability to build valves that lasted very long. So you had drums always. You had cymbals always. You had horns. You know, they would have some holes in them, but that's about all. I think reed instruments were relatively a modern thing, but you know, they're made out of reeds, which were available thousands of years ago, so they could have had primitive instruments like that. So, you know, there's a lot that they know. There's a lot, unfortunately, they don't know, because a lot of things weren't written down. They just had to find these bits and pieces of old instruments and figure out what the hell they were doing with them. But just getting back to Williams, you know, there's a lot of woo-woo stuff on the internet about all kinds of things. The golden ratio is a real woo-woo thing, that it unlocks the you know, all kinds of the power of nature. And the problem is that it's mostly BS. A lot of things that are promoted as being the golden ratio, if you actually measure it, they're not the golden ratio. So it's another one of those woo-woo stories that people tell each other on the internet.
Yeah, oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, woo-woo stories. I think that's what this is. Apparently, you know, there was a time when they had to have a synchronized idea of time as well as frequency for a standard, and apparently it was in the 30s when they decided this thing. And anyway, they illustrate these stupid YouTube videos with these pictures of water energized with these different frequencies. And those look very different. Like if the 432 frequency is this blobby thing, but then, and you get, no, the 440 thing is a blobby thing, and the 432 thing is this more snowflake looking thing. So I don't know, it seems weird. And then I was wondering how they energized the water. So I watched the stupid YouTube, and they didn't ever show anything about how they energized the water to make it look like that. It's like, you got all this hype that's sitting around on the front, and then you click in it, and it's not that at all. So it gets very boring with that kind of stuff after a while.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff is just clickbait, unfortunately, and a lot of it is fraudulent. You know, they'll show you these random little images, and they'll tell you that they use this frequency when they don't have the faintest idea what frequency anyone used. And energizing water is one of the biggest cons on the internet. There are companies that sell water energizers for thousands of dollars that do squat. There's an alkaline movement where you could live forever if you just alkalinize your body. So you're supposed to put a little basic solution in your water, and they'll give you some for only $100 a bottle. It's all a scam. And there are others where they promote that their water, it comes from a river that's exposed to the moon, so it has moon energy in it. They're all scams. There was one interesting scam where people actually had the nerve to sell people dirt. They dug up dirt someplace in Canada and shipped it around the world, told people to put it in their water, rub it on their skin, and they actually made some money for a while.
Yeah, but Roy, we had pet rocks when I was a kid. So, I mean, dirt, rocks, it's the same thing. But you get back to reality here. This the Schumann frequency thing, what actually is that? Is that sort of a flow back and forth echo between the atmosphere and the Earth, or it's supposedly around 8 hertz. So I was wondering, do you know anything about it?
Yeah, it's a half-assed, if you pardon the expression, waveguide. You know, just like if you take any kind of conducting material and have a dimension that's related to a wavelength, it will kind of ricochet and go from one end of the waveguide to the other with relatively less loss than most other transmission lines. So Schumann frequency is sort of the Earth's version of a waveguide. It's not a perfect waveguide because the ionosphere and the Earth are not perfect conductors, and they don't have perfect dimensions. So it's an approximation that's kind of fluctuates a little bit of this, a little bit of that. The guys who are really looking for over-unity energy and lossless energy transfer across the world are looking at Schumann frequencies as a means of doing it. They think that if they could take a lot of energy and turn it into 8 hertz energy and somehow radiate it because of Schumann resonances, you can get that energy to go to the other side of the world with almost no energy loss, which is not a thing that works.
Well, that sounds interesting. I thought Tesla was doing that, but I think he was using higher frequency out at Windermere. And he was trying to find the same type of thing, but it seemed like he was using a megacycle. Do you know what frequency Tesla was using out at Long Island there?
I would assume that he was working in the high kilocycles. You know, those were the olden days. It was very difficult to get something that efficiently oscillated at high frequencies. The only reason why the Naval Department gave amateur radio operators 160 meters and above was because the Navy thought that all those frequencies above 160 meters and above, that's about 1.4 megahertz, were worthless. So I would hazard a guess that he was trying it in the high kilohertz. And I think that was before people had an appreciation for Schumann frequencies. So Tesla was just listening to his own weird ideas. Tesla had, unfortunately, a lot of weird ideas. Towards the end, there is a legitimate reporter who interviewed him, and he told the reporter that he's married to a pigeon that lives outside his windowsill where he lives in a hotel. So he was a little flaky towards the end. But he was into all those lossless energy transfers. Of course, he built the that big tower in Long Island. There were a bunch of people in Texas that built a replica. They were going to make trillions of dollars with free energy and free energy transfer. And, of course, they went bankrupt.
Well, I guess I've seen people that have built those kind of towers, but they go around between rock concerts and they put people in cages and they zap the heck out of them with these giant lightning bolts, and you can pay to have that done. So I've seen that before, but it seems like it creates a lot of interference.
Well, yeah, it creates a heck of a lot of interference. That was, unfortunately, that was what spark gap transmitters often did. The only way you knew what frequency you were operating on was the length of your half-wave dipole. If your length of your half-wave dipole was 40 meters, you were operating on somehow on 40 meters, or at least the 40-meter portion of the energy coming out of the spark gap transmitter. So, yeah, it makes a lot of noise. But his tower in Long Island, I think, was something like 40 or 50 feet. So, you know, it's these theatrical Tesla coils on steroids. It was a massive device and probably would be illegal. The FCC would probably shut anyone down who tried to use it because it would probably cover the surrounding 50 miles in so much RFI that cell towers would go down and broadcast bands would be noisy as heck. It would just be a mess. So probably a good thing that that place in Texas went bankrupt.
Well, I agree. That's a pretty big problem. One of the things I also found out this week was interesting was about these things called sprites in the upper atmosphere that are basically red flashes that last for a very short period of time. You have a 100,000-frame camera, and it catches one frame of it, and they had some pictures of that, you know, on NASA. So I thought that was interesting. Never heard of these sprite things before. There's the donuts, and then there are these jellyfish-looking things. Quite wild.
Yeah, it's a type of lightning.
Yeah, but it's in the upper atmosphere, so when there's a lightning bolt that makes a blue, like, strike on the ground, then someplace also nearby there's a red flash high up, and they can see it from the space station. So anyway, you can't really observe it because you say, oh, it just happened because it was so short. You just don't notice it.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon that takes place way above the cloud layer in the mesosphere. Well, once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. And this is the second Wednesday, so we're here. So if anyone out there has any topics that they'd like to discuss or questions that they would like to ask, please feel free. I'll just throw out another little bit that I know about Nikola Tesla. He really did not like Albert Einstein. He didn't believe in the theory of relativity. He thought that he had discovered a particle coming from the sun that was traveling faster than the speed of light, and I think he was planning to call it a Teslion. If he had more proof of it. Science sort of thinks that he might have been misunderstanding how neutrinos work. But neutrinos don't go faster than the speed of light in the vacuum because nothing goes faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Now, one of many things that Tesla, unfortunately, got wrong as he got older. Anyway, I think I distracted people by adding some information that no one particularly either knew or cared about. This continues to be the Technical Net, so if you have any questions of a technical nature or if you have a topic you'd like to discuss, question you'd like to ask, a comment you'd like to make, then please feel free, hit that push to talk and say your piece.
NVB with an audio question.
Okay.
Roy, I'm I'm looking into possibly buying a Bluetooth set of headphones, you know, and then, of course, they include, and with noise canceling. And this particular model is a Bose model. I'm not going to read more about it, but it has one thing where you can turn the noise canceling down, but you can't turn it off. I'm wondering about this noise canceling technology. You probably know something about it. Does it in any way have artifacts that detract from the sound of the music, like when you don't need the noise canceling or whatever? I know that if you got noise, it's probably it's a net plus, but I'm wondering if that kind of technology interferes with the signal at all, or if you know anything about that. Back to you.
Yeah, the noise canceling headphones and earpieces are very, very popular. I have Apple Pro earpieces. They let me turn off the noise canceling. The way I have it configured is I tap it on the side, and it turns off the noise canceling, which I prefer. So I'm not quite sure why the Bose wouldn't let you do that. It depends on the manufacturer and what year it was manufactured. If it's done poorly, in the old days, you could have artifacts. In modern days, at least the ones that I've listened to, 99% of the time, there are no artifacts. Occasionally, you hear these strange little squeals when it's getting misread. It makes sense how it works. These are little headphone things that have microphones built into them. So not only are you listening to the music, but your headphones are listening to your background noise, and they do a phase inversion and feed it directly into your headphones that cancels a significant portion. It's usually not 100%, but it's somewhere between 70 and 90, or sometimes on a good day 95. So if you got an air conditioner humming in the background and you turn them on, it still hums, but it hums much lightly than it did with the noise cancellation turned off. So it's good technology. Bose makes a very good version of it. Apple does too. Sony does also. There's a lot of them out there, and you really should kind of look into it. What looks more comfortable for your ear? What features they have? What price points they ask you to pay for, because they're all about the same in, as far as quality, although you're always going to find people who love Sonys and only Sonys, and others who are only going to buy Bose. I went through Bose stage when I was about 16 years old, and I went out the other end. So Boses tend to be a wee bit overpriced for what they offer. But as far as the noise cancellation, they certainly are good with the technology these days.
So I've been reading about, I'm going up to, I guess that Apple one is like $500. The ones, I'm talking about over-the-ear headphones, that's what I'm looking at. And there's a Sony and there's a Bose. A Bose is just coming out. It's brand new model, the particular one I'm looking at the moment. So the reviews are kind of incomplete at the moment. You have to wait another month probably, or another 2 weeks anyway, get the full lowdown. But there was one thing they were saying, and it was kind of a little critique, where like you can turn down the noise canceling, but for some reason on this model you can't turn it off. And I guess a lot of the other models you can. It would be nice to be able to just turn it off. But the only noise canceling I have a pair of you stick in your ear, and they're not technology, but they were a $300 pair of earpieces. They're good, high quality transducers, but just earplugs that block 25 dB just because it's an earplug and you put this thing in your ear, and I used to use that, but it's not as comfortable, so I'm just thinking of getting these headphones that are, they're wireless, so I can do that wireless thing when I want to, but it also has the good ones that also you can also use a wire, go back to that, for especially when the device doesn't have Bluetooth or what have you. Anyway, so I'm reading about these things, so looking at sodium, looking at Bose, and I should probably look at the Apple one too. Back to you.
Yeah, you should look at the competitors. I'm willing to bet you the Bose is going to be its price point is very close to Apple's. I've never known Bose to be a bargain. They promoted themselves very well, and they want you to pay dearly for that brand name. I use those the other type of earpieces. They're passive. It's not that they actively phase invert the background noise. They just plug up your ear canal so that the only thing you can hear through is the little hearing piece. So, you know, depending upon how well it's designed to dampen external noise, it gets rid of the background. It depends on how sensitive your ear canal is, though, because there are different methods it uses to seal up the ear canal. I think usually the best method tends to have multiple flanges that can really irritate your ear canal. There are others where it's just kind of foam rubber that forms itself in this somewhat of a sealed ear canal. But yeah, I've played with those too. I mean, the big boys who have a lot of money to spend will go to a professional to have a mold made of their ear canals and have the earpieces molded based on that. So it's a perfect fit. I mean, you know, you have to put the right ear in the right plug and the left ear in the left plug because we're not symmetrical as far as our ear canal is concerned.
Got a pair of those. Like musicians often get those. I spent like $300 just to get these earplugs, and then you can put little cylinder things in them to take out 15 dB or 25. That's what they call it anyway. So when I go in the subway, I just stick in those foam earplugs because they actually block out more noise than this thing, even when it's fully, quote unquote, fully blocked. But I'm very sensitive to noise. I think I have ear damper damage because sirens just are like pain to me. I'm like sticking my fingers in my skull and looking around at these calm people walking on the street going, what the heck's wrong with these people? But it's not just that I'm sensitive. I think I have dampers in my ears that ironically get damaged by noise. I've been told by ear doctors and such. I'm sure that's what I have. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, and unfortunately, especially among musicians, there's a lot of people with hearing loss because they're exposed to high acoustic pressures very often. And that's one of the reasons why everyone started to wear earplugs to kind of help that, to an extent. But still, the more noise that you hear, the more screwed up your hearing is. Every so often, I'll hear some movie star complain that he was on a stage where they had blanks being shot right next to his ears, and you know he was almost deaf from them.
Yeah, I mean, well, people our age, you know, like, I played in rock, my first rock band when I was 16, like a junior high school, like this was like 1972, and nobody that I knew had any consciousness about ear protection. We were loud. We were as loud as anything. And some of these wedding jobs I played in the 80s and stuff, they're probably just as loud. And I didn't start getting wise enough to even roll up napkins or make spitballs to put in my ears until like the early 90s. So, anyway, yeah, I definitely
done
some damage.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stories about a lot of things similar. I must have mentioned it in the past. No one quite understood about radiation. So back, I think, in the 30s, Florsheim, the shoe store, put out a fluoroscope so that you could put your feet under the fluoroscope and you could wiggle the bones of your toes and see them through the shoe you're planning to buy. So a lot of x-rays people got exposed to, a lot of radiation. People had tincture of tritium because they thought that the radiation would invigorate them. So there's a lot of things that we messed around with in chemistry. I mentioned before that I ground holes in asbestos pads, right next to me. I had big bottles of benzene solvent that I was using that I was exposed to. So, you know, we lived in a much more dangerous world back then.
Yes, and not to mention, I remember being like 6 years old in a Navy hospital, and I'm sure it was probably true in any other hospital. You're sitting in an emergency room, or not an emergency, just a waiting room, and people are sick. They're very smoking cigarettes, and there's smoke, places full of smoke. No one thought anything of it.
Well, I mean, the really bad thing was if you go back to the 50s and the early 60s, there were a lot of doctors who smoked in the office. So you can imagine what a ridiculous thing it is. You come in for asthma, and your pediatrician is sitting there smoking Marlboros while he's listening to your wheezing.
I'm getting this, I don't know if you're hearing it, but I'm getting all that microphone, like I used to get with the old bad microphone, but this is a good microphone with a good clip, but it does it even when it's not in. But, yeah, I just say, I remember being 3 years old and the doctor making a house call. Yes, house calls. This is 1959. I don't remember, he wasn't smoking when we were, but I just remember the pack of cigarettes in his pocket and smelling it in his breath and everything. No one thought about it in those days. Of course, I didn't at the age of three.
Unfortunately, doctors were like everyone else. They clueless at one point. And I remember my pediatrician coming for house calls when I was a little kid. So that was the very early 60s. And I remember he comes in and he says he has a cold. And my mother says, penicillin. And the doctor says, well, it's really not going to do anything for a cold. But she said, give it to him anyway. And he said, fine, wonderful. So my mother talked him into a penicillin shot, and I guess he felt bad for me because he actually gave me the syringe afterwards, which I used to play around with plants in the backyard. It was a kind of fruitless endeavor. Syringes don't work well with plants.
You were shooting up plants?
That was the easiest thing to do, was the plants. I wasn't going to do animals. I wasn't going to particularly... Insects are kind of difficult. You know, they won't stay still. But plants stay still all the time. You know, I mean, sometimes you could... If you had dandelions, if you ever pulled one apart, they're kind of hollow. They're tubes. So you could inject things into dandelions stems. But it never really went very far. But I got to play with syringes long before I got my license.
There you go. Yes, that helps your future career. Maybe that's what started making you thinking about being a doctor. I don't know.
No, not really. I mean, I suffer from... I really do not like the sight of my own blood. But fortunately, I figured out somewhere between high school and college that I don't really mind anyone else's blood. It's my blood that I mind seeing. And for the most part, you don't see your own blood in medicine. Unless you make some terrible mistake.
Right, yeah. So, things have definitely changed a bit.
Yep. Yeah, if you wait long enough, everything is dangerous. But the problem is now we're kind of, the pendulum is swinging somewhat in the opposite direction. We have developed such sophisticated analytical and quantitative analysis tools that we can detect one molecule in a billion. So, you know, if there's one arsenic atom and, you know, in distilled water, some people won't drink it. You know, they don't quite understand that it's not whether or not something's in the water, it's how much of it is in the water, because almost everything is in the water.
Probably every glass of water you encounter would have one arsenic atom or one atom of something equally bad, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, you never know. And it's not a good thing, actually, to drink distilled water. You know, some people have this kind of confused idea about it that, you know, distilled water is pure water and the best thing is pure water. But the human body needs salts, electrolytes, potassium, chloride, sodium, all those things. So if you were on some really weird diet, which I understand one of those magician guys put himself on for some foolish reason, you can make yourself even sicker just drinking distilled water. You can also drink heavy water in small amounts. If you take in too much and it gets incorporated into your body chemistry, it changes equilibrium states because heavy water reacts a little bit different than light water. But you know, you could have, say, a shot of heavy water and live to tell the tale.
What is heavy water? Is that H3O?
No, it's deuterium oxide. It's instead of the hydrogen, it uses deuterium, which is hydrogen with an extra neutron in each nucleus.
So I'm kind of get my rusty memories of high school chemistry. Yeah, it's because regular hydrogen has no neutrons at all, right? So it's like a proton and a neutron instead of just a proton.
Yeah, for all intents and purposes, a normal hydrogen is just a proton with an electron circling it. Matter of fact, one of the questions I asked for one of my Limark TechNet puzzles, they're different than the puzzles I have here, is I asked people, what does a proton taste like?
Taste it, but yeah, I knew about the electron. I just assumed I just left that out. Yeah, I don't know. It's probably nothing.
Actually, it's sour. That's an acidic medium throw out protonated water. So if you were to put a proton on your taste receptors, it would read it as as an acidic material and be sour.
Wow. I mean, if it was just one proton, would you even notice it? It would probably be a few more, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's you know, I don't go into the idea of intensity. Just if it had a flavor, which most people would think it wouldn't, because why the hell would we evolve to be able to taste a proton? You know, the effect one proton would have would be minuscule. But in general speaking, when we're tasting something acidic, we're basically tasting excessive protons being presented to our taste buds.
Now you can say, that tastes like a proton.
Well, yeah, I mean, nowadays when we know the difference between, you know, you have to realize 100 years ago, people had no idea about protons or neutrons. And when they first heard about neutrons, they were told that they were neutral, only to discover that they're actually have a net neutral charge. They're a compound particle made out of positively and negatively charged smaller particles called quarks.
Right, the quarks, so it's an equal number of positive and negative. There's like, what, typically four quarks in a neutron or something like that. And if there's two of one, two positive, two negative, you have a neutral.
There are three quarks in a neutron and a proton. Protons have two up quarks and one down quark. Neutrons have two down quarks and one up quark. An up quark is, minus two-thirds. A down is plus one-third each. So when you add them up, they come out to be zero.
Oh, I see. I'm not sure if I just got this backwards. My short-term memory is getting shorter. So whichever one, the one the up is twice as strong as the down, so you need two downs and to equal an up, or maybe I got it exactly backwards.
No, it's actually worse and far more complicated. It's something called quantum chromodynamics, in that there's a triplet, and we give it a goofy name that'll cause people to be confused. So there are supposedly red, green, and blue quarks, and there are anti-red, anti-green, and anti-blue quarks. And in order for a particle to be stable, it either has to have all red, green, and blue, or none of them. So, there are things that are made out of two quarks where one is green and the other is minus green. So it zeroes out. Otherwise, you need three, so it's red, green, and blue. So that's why you need either two tops and one bottom, or two bottoms and one top. They have to be red, green, and blue in order to have the colors come out right.
Red, green, and anti-green, that's not the same thing as antimatter, because I guess that would just make the whole thing annihilate itself.
Yeah, color and anti-color are different than anti-particles.
I thought so. I think I just stumbled on a little bit of this info reading some wiki page about Gell-Mann. I think he's the guy who came up with quarks, or the guy named them or something. I think he discovered them. Back to you.
Yeah, these things usually start as theoretical constructs, and very often people put silly names on them, and then unfortunately they stick. So I think quark came from some English poet, writing about nonsense words, and they just grabbed quark and used it. The term Big Bang was originally meant to be derisive, to demonstrate people's disgust with the idea. And for some reason, everyone just grabbed it and went with it. So there's a lot of naming conventions that you think people sat down and thought a great deal about it when they really didn't.
Yeah, I think Gell-Mann was the one that used the word quark because he had a side interest in this poetry, or he knew about this poet or something. He's the one that took that poet's. I think I read that on a wiki page or something. Yeah. And the thing about like Big Bang, it's kind of like now people will use geek and nerd in a positive way to say the guy's really smart or expert in that field or something. With a tongue-in-cheek way, or sort of tongue-in-cheek way to brag, but sounding like you're being self-deprecating.
Yeah, words kind of shift in their meaning. The old meaning for the word nice is a very negative word. If you would have, something like 300 years ago, if you would have called someone nice, they would probably punch you in the face. So you gotta watch historically where words come from and what happens to them. As far as nerd and such, I don't think it ever got really bad historically. Geek, unfortunately, did. I think there was a time that people used the term geek, such as circus geeks. These were the kind of bottom of the barrel performers who just did disgusting things because people would pay them to do it, like, you know, bite the head off of a chicken or something.
Roy, are you hearing all that clicking and stuff like it used to be when I had that broken microphone connector? I'm getting it on this end with this good microphone. Are you hearing it on your end?
Yes, I am. And I'm assuming that it happens when I let go and it happens when you let go. It's probably not you or me. It's probably some flaky thing going on with the repeater, I would guess.
Yeah, because sometimes it's... I mean, sometimes, I don't know, just doing a head trip on me. Sometimes I think it's happening more when my mic's plugged in, but it definitely happens quite a bit even when it's not. I sometimes just pull it out just to reassure myself, oh, it's not, at least it's not just my microphone, because you're talking to William or something, I'll be hearing this stuff too, or whatever.
Well, I mean, the trick is to look at your radio and see if it's transmitting. When I kind of let go from this concoction I have, I can just stare at my radio, and it's when it's making the noise, it's going green. So it's not transmitting the click; it's receiving the click, and I assume you're receiving the click as well. So something else is actually pumping energy into the world. So my best guess, again, is that the repeater is set a little bit too sensitive, and it's just keying up with some kind of feedback mechanism.
Yeah, because at least it doesn't do it in the middle of a transmission. It always does it when someone lets go of the push the talk button, it seems.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the problem is. Maybe the PL tone sensitivity is set too low or something, but it's a regular pulse until it just kind of dies out. So again, it seems to me like some kind of feedback circuit somewhere in either the controller or the repeater itself.
Right, and it's something that does it like several times in a row, boom, 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 as you know. What if there's anyone out there with a question? Is that possible?
Yes, that would be very, very nice. I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're hopefully, we're available to try to answer questions or at least make discussions. I see our president, Maxim, is on Echolink. I hope he's listening. We were discussing this kind of strange echo of clicks that sometimes happen when I unkey and Bob unkeys. And because our radios are showing reception and not transmission, it's not my radio and it's not Bob's radio. So it might be the repeater is doing something a wee bit flaky. Well, nothing much heard. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We do have a puzzle tonight. If people want to take a look at it, it is a image, an illustration. So you do have to look at the illustration in order to have the faintest idea what I'm talking about. Basically, it gives you four illustrations of an oscilloscope tracing and asks you to discern which of those four oscilloscope tracings are characteristic of someone sending Morse code. So once again, we'll ask anyone if they have any questions or topics for tonight, but if there are no more, then I guess we'll go to the puzzle.
I'll take a stab at the puzzle if there's nothing else going on. This is
Yeah, Bob, if you want to take a gander at it and tell me what you think, feel free.
It looks like it looks like C, because that just looks like a da and two dits, the letter D for the letter C. Da, da, dit. But that's just my guess. It just kind of looks like a da and two dits on letter C.
And you are quite right. See, if I was probably thinking ahead, I would have probably shuffled them around, because that's the Morse code for D. So I would have probably made that the answer D, but I didn't even think about that. Nevertheless, you are quite right. The point being that there is no modulated wave on Morse code. On continuous wave, it's only a binary signal. It's on or off. Now, if you do it too quickly, though, you will produce harmonics at the points where it stops and starts again, and that's usually called chirping. So the oscilloscope would probably more likely show a little bit rounding of the edges of those wave envelopes, so that harmonics would not be heard and you wouldn't be scolded for having a transmitter that chirps too much. But you are quite right. The answer is the oscilloscope tracing documented as C.
So does none of those A, B, or D, that's not what chirping signals would look like. Those are just something else, I guess, right?
Chirping is harmonics. So in other words, whereas you're just listening to whatever the offset frequency of the carrier is, if you are transitioning from a signal to nothing too quickly, what happens is it generates harmonics of higher and higher frequencies that beat with each other and just produces a kind of mushy beginning and end to your dits and dahs. And that's what chirping is. I mean, on some oscilloscope setup for it, you can kind of see what it generates, a lot of noise. And, you know, in illustrations that show curving the CW signals ever so slightly, you recognize that they're just a little rounded at the edges. It's not a sharp cutoff.
Right. You know, I'm starting to think that my microphone's making this thing worse, because when I pull it out, you hear like bam, bam, you hit it maybe once or twice. Sometimes I have it in, it does it like a whole bunch of times, and then I pull it out and it does it one or two more and stops.
Well, I mean, it is possible that the contact in the radio is dirty and it's not making a perfect, consistent contact. And it's sort of acting like the carbon granules of an old telephone and reproducing the background vibrations.
Yeah, I think maybe using that busted microphone connector for so long, maybe that bent some of the internal connectors in that plug, jack plug, whatever you call it, the female one, and so that the little contacts are bent a little, and so it's not contacting as well, even now that I have a good plug.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible, and yeah, it's called a jack.
Female is the jack, is that right?
The female is a jack.
The male should be the jack, the female should be the Jill, but whatever.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the male is the plug.
Gotcha. I just got to say this. I hope this is not too risque, but there's a funny cartoonist named Kleban, who drew the cartoons in the 70s. He was kind of out there. He had this one that called Genitals of the Universe. And this one was just like some alien genitals. It was like a plug and a wall socket, but they were made out of protoplasm, and these were genitals of the universe. Anyway, it's kind of funny.
Yeah, there have been many people making jokes about sundry connectors, you know, and their maleness and their femaleness. And as time has gone on, electrical engineers have let their imagination go quite crazy. You know, I mean, in the beginning, it made more sense. A jack was you know, it was like a cave. It was, you know, everything went into it, and the plug was plugging into the jack. But now you have protrusions on jacks. You have intrusions on plugs, and it's getting as confusing as everything else in the modern world.
So about this jack in my radio, maybe first thing I try is just blow some compressed air into it, and I don't know what I can do beyond that. I mean, it'd be tricky for me to try to, I guess you could check those little prong connectors if I see some are kind of, they probably all sort of supposed to be parallel in a line. I don't know if I should look in there with a magnifying glass or what, if it just blowing it doesn't help.
Well, you know, it depends on how curious you are. I'm always curious. So I have actually a magnifying glass with a built-in little LED, so it gives my own illumination. So I would probably just poke an eye and take a look inside. Also, if you have some kind of contact cleaner, probably that would be the best thing to try to give a squirt in there. Because, you know, in case there's some corrosion, some schmutz got in there, then that should help get rid of that.
Contact cleaners. I think I ordered this stuff that you mentioned once. It was in a big spray can. But let me pull this thing up and read the label. What is it called? You mentioned this on one of your nets. I can't read it because there's another piece that's blocking the word. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, I think it's called Deoxy. It's just a deoxidizing contact cleaner. I, matter of fact, I probably told the story. I had a problem with my paper shredder, and the main on-off switch, you basically had to wiggle it around to get it to work because apparently some piece of paper dust got into the contact. So I gave it a good squirt with that stuff, and I never had a problem again.
Okay, I'll try that. That's what it is. Yeah, that's definitely what it is. It's this giant can. It looks like an overkill. I might spray 100 times as much as I need. Maybe I can spray it onto a Q-tip swab and then do it that way. I don't know.
Well, the solvent evaporates rather quickly, so it's not like you're pouring in WD-40 something. You know, it'll spritz around and then just most of it will evaporate and not be visible. But you know, if you want to use a Q-tip and that, just you got to be quick about it because again, it evaporates rather quickly. And yeah, those cans are usually, depending upon what you do for a living, as long as you're not a guy who fixes this stuff, it's probably a good 20 years supply that comes in that can.
Right, this stuff might decompose or the propellant might stop working before I run out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things, but it's one of those things that I usually tell people you might as well, you know, if you're into this hobby at all, you might as well have a can of that because eventually you're going to need it.
That's good. Yeah. Well, I'll try that. It'll be interesting to see if it changes any of this.
Okay, I'm a little curious. Now, when it makes those clicks, I assume your receiver isn't flashing red light that you're transmitting. So that would confuse why it would be you, but maybe it does flash red. I don't know.
It flashes flashes red every time.
Then we have a solution, it's you. Because nothing is going to make your radio flash red except you. There's no signal out there that's going to cause it. So that we now have the solution. It's not the repeater. It's, unfortunately, your transmitter doing it.
But it does it less, but it still does it when I unplug my microphone.
Well, it could be something that's broken in it, or it could be that the contacts got bent and they're too close to each other, and any kind of local vibration makes it think that you hit the push to talk.
But, well, that's the one I heard one. I had removed the microphone intentionally while you were talking, so when you signed off, and I only heard one of those things, but it did not flash red. I think when it's unplugged, well, I'll still keep looking to see if that's always true, but if it doesn't flash red when it's unplugged, then it's not only me. It's just me. It's the worst when I got my mic plugged in, and I'm adding to it the whole thing.
Okay. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the repeater does kind of issue a courtesy end of transmission. Beep. So you're going to get that from the repeater. It's the beep, 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 beep thing that's probably your radio.
Okay, I'll keep. From now on, if you get in a conversation with somebody else and it starts doing that a bunch, I'll just kind of look at the light and take note of that. I wasn't thinking about it before.
Okay, very good. Let me once again ask if there's anyone else out there. I mean, I see people on EchoLink, but if anyone has any questions or comments to make before we call this episode to an end, please hit that push to talk. Oh, well, I guess we're done for tonight, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. I got some things I should... I don't want to stay up too late tonight. I got some big day tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, very good. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be November 1st, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from about 9 to 10, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. You just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, please address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by a local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. Well, we're going to roll this all up and shut it down, but we'll be back October 25th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks again to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a safe week, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS, clear.
industry, Roy. Good, interesting net. Good net, even if there's low attendance.
Thank you.